Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper on December 10th, Sunday, December 10th, 2017. And so we've had our first snowfall.
Right.
It's very Christmassy,
right.
I would say,
mm-hmm.
in the area. Quite chilly. And during the snow, which occurred yesterday on Saturday, we decided it was a good day for a field trip to New York City.
Right.
Because you don't get enough New York during the week.
Well, because it was the most treacherous driving we could encounter under the circumstances. But it really wasn't that bad, honestly.
No, it wasn't so bad.
And the snow kept the traffic down.
Some people in front of us thought it was bad.
Yeah, we had that.
It kept us from proceeding.
It was a miraculous day in New York City for two reasons. First of all, we went to a very nice restaurant, the name of which is...
Bouvette.
We went with our friend the Walters, and it was a lovely little French restaurant.
Yes, we barely stopped. Going in through the tunnel, Holland Tunnel.
Let me get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
But the restaurant was very lovely, very French, and very little. It was all cramped, but it was a real urban, fun, I don't know, almost European experience. You almost felt like you were in Paris or something like that. And we were ordering these little bits of French food and drinking. And
looking out the window at their little courtyard,
yeah.
The snow falling, and the little quaint chairs.
Right. Then we had what I would call two experiences that make an impression. The first one has to do with parking. We had an amazing parking karma. Lisa Walsh, who accompanied us with her husband Tom, has what's called parking karma. I don't know if scientists are onto this, but when Lisa's driving or you happen to be lucky enough to be with Lisa, you will find a parking space in the most unusual circumstances. To wit, we found a space downtown near the restaurant. That's good. That's an A-.
On the street, a block from the restaurant.
But then...
In the West Village.
Yes, but then in contravention of all logic, we drove to the Met, the Metropolitan Museum, on the Upper East Side in the upper 70s, low 80s, and we parked basically right in front of the Metropolitan on the street.
Fifth Avenue.
As if it was sort of a Cadillac advertisement. It didn't make any sense at all. I've never seen anybody do that.
Yes.
And it was crazy. Crazy.
We drove up, hopped out of the car, and clambered our way into
it. It was miraculous. So compared to that, you really couldn't ask the Michelangelo sketches to live up to that kind of
experience.
Well,
being from Jersey, we're all about logistics.
Exactly.
So when travel works, when commuting works,
it works.
We're delighted.
We are delighted.
But anyway, we went in to see the Michelangelo exhibition, and which you were not impressed by.
No. Don't say that. But it's not my thing. It's much more your thing. So what did you think?
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Okay.
I highly enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was great to see... In some cases, things I had only read about and seen in pictures and saw for real. I saw new things I had never seen. I learned new ideas and aspects about his technique and procedures, etc., his collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a wonderful quarter scale, what would you call it, a reproduction of the Sistine Chapel.
Oh, that's right. Yes, they had a faux ceiling. It was on the ceiling. It was impressive.
Yeah, and it was close enough so you could really see it.
It was quite illuminated.
So you got a really good image.
Yeah, we've been fortunate enough to see the Sistine Chapel, and we can confidently say it looked pretty similar. So I think they knew what they were doing.
That's true. But there was also I think one of my favorite things was a copy that someone had painted of Michelangelo's Last Judgment. That's the wall over, in where the main altar would be.
In the chapel.
In the front of the chapel,
yeah.
what you might call the front. It was painted after Michelangelo died. They had somebody paint over all the dicey bits of the naked saints and angels, etc. And this was done before that happened, and other changes were made. It was fun to see that before the changes. Anyway.
And we got home through the Lincoln Tunnel like nobody's business. So.
Again, logistics.
Yes, what a great journey. almost religious, almost biblical. And speaking of which, since we're in the Christmas spirit, the first book review that caught our attention had to do with Christmas.
We wanted to talk about about art that would appeal to you.
So we have
Michelangelo, yeah. A great sculptor.
That's right.
Mostly a carver of marble.
Yeah.
But a sculptor that's in the news this week would be what?
The Heisman Trophy.
The Heisman Trophy. They gave out the Heisman Trophy.
This weekend. And it went to Baker Mayfield, a quarterback for Oklahoma. But we're not the kind of folks who are interested in the football aspect of it. We, like the writers of the New York Times, want to know how you make the Heisman Trophy.
Funny that you can talk with your tongue in your cheek that way.
This was the biggest article the Times had on it. But fortunately, I'm here with an expert who actually would know how to make the trophy.
Well, there was a big article about the making of it. Do you have the article? I don't seem to have the article. So it just, it goes, the New York Times bothers to go step by step of the making of the article.
Right.
The making of the trophy.
In case you were called upon to make the trophy.
Right. It's made actually in Oklahoma. The company, MTM Recognition,
mm-hmm.
is the trophy company that's in charge of making it now and has been since 2005. And they use a time-honored lost wax method, which involves making a mold and having a wax model of it. And then around that is put an investment, is kind of a candy coating, and the wax is melted out, hence the lost aspect. And then you have this kind of investment, what they call investment mold, that they send out to a foundry that's filled with bronze.
But not filled completely, filled with a little bit of a hollow aspect to it, otherwise it would be too heavy.
Yeah, the article makes that more confusing than it is. It does, it's not that it's not filled completely. On the inside, it has a kind of filling,
mm-hmm.
so that really the wax model is itself hollow, just going around,
mm-hmm.
this center core,
mm-hmm.
that's stabilized. Okay, so that when you pour in the bronze, it goes around that core.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Because as the article points out, if they didn't do that, this little sculpture would weigh 200 pounds.
Exactly.
And, well, it would cost a lot more, too,
right.
because of all that bronze. But you don't need that. And then once the bronze is cooled, you break off that candy coating,
right.
the investment
right.
and you shine it up, chase away any seams and fill any holes, and also you may alter the color of it. That's called the patina.
Mm-hmm.
And the article, of course, says, well, you want to make it look old, don't you? It's a patina. We think of patina as making something look old, but it's really about whatever color,
mm-hmm.
the sculptor wants it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sprayed with an acid that will react with the bronze and turn that color.
Right.
Sometimes you want a greenish tinge, sometimes brown. And there's an iconic color to the
greenish, I think.
Yeah. No, it's more brownish.
More brown?
It's like shoe leather or something.
Well,
but what's interesting here also is that this company actually got to alter the sculpture or
mm-hmm.
improve it
mm-hmm.
a little bit. There were a couple of glitches to it, and this Jack Nortz, an employee of the company, was delighted that he gets to do a little sculpting because the right shoe didn't have laces.
Mm-hmm.
So they went back and added laces to it. And also there was a deal with the arm.
Right,
it was sometimes
pointing the wrong direction.
The arm was cast separately because it sticks out,
right.
In a delicate way. So it's easier to cast if you do that separately. So they actually did a little square in the shoulder,
mm-hmm.
so that now the arm can only ever fit in a particular direction.
Okay.
Hard to visualize. Right, right. But,
so now you know how to make the Heisman Trophy. The question is how you take the Heisman Trophy. And that has actually become increasingly controversial, or not, depending on how seriously you take the Heisman Trophy. Who wins?
Okay.
And
you mean how you feel about it? Do you care?
Well, you might care, you might not. But the point is that it is the best football player, the one who gets the Heisman Trophy. Well, I guess the general feeling is no. But the reason people feel that way is because it's not unusual for the Heisman Trophy winner to be a complete fail in professional football. That has caused some to say that there's a so-called curse associated with the Heisman Trophy. I don't think there's a curse. I don't even think it's surprising that it works out that way.
Don't you think college football is different from professional football?
That's exactly
so
why.
To be the best in college...
Doesn't mean you're
the
best in
the
pros.
It's not like the award is for the guy who will do the best in the future.
Right.
It's really...
Right, and here's what exacerbates it. The truth is the Heisman Trophy doesn't go to the best football player. It goes to the best quarterback. The Heisman Trophy, or the last 20 Heismans, I think 17 have been quarterbacks. That's just the way they do it. Those are the guys who get the most publicity. And because they get the most ink, they get the Heisman Trophy. And there is no position that varies as greatly from college to pros as quarterback. It's a very different position. So, you know, it doesn't mean you can't succeed as a quarterback. You know, the last four Heisman Trophy quarterback winners to come out are Marcus Mariota, who's doing well, Jameis Winston, doing well, Donnie Manziel, who I think is in prison, and R.G. Griffin III, who is doing something probably other than football. So you just can't tell.
I guess the biggest fail I know of mm-hmm. is Tim Tebow.
Tim Tebow, right.
I guess he was like a superstar. I mean, right. Talk about a guy who had ink.
He had a great ink. He was a great college player. He won the Heisman in 2007, and he failed. You know, but it's not as if the pros are not onto this. You know, if you go back to 2003, a guy named Jason White, the quarterback of Oklahoma, won the Heisman Trophy, and his team was number one. Jason White did not even get drafted. Forget number one. Forget the first round. Didn't get drafted in the entire draft by the pros. He signed as a free agent and was asked to play a position other than quarterback because they felt he couldn't play quarterback at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he failed at the other position. He was out of the pros in just a few months. No one would be worrying about that except that the winner this year is Baker Mayfield. He is the quarterback of guess who? Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And do we have another Jason White? Or do we have a Sam Bradford who won it for Oklahoma in 2008 and has had a decent pro career? I will tell you that there are three quarterbacks who were rated very highly in this year's draft. They are Sam Darnold of USC, they are Josh Rosen of UCLA, and they are Josh Allen of Wyoming, and none of them was a finalist for the Heisman Trophy.
Hmm. Right.
All right, let's get to that Christmas book. We're eager to get to that. Yes.
Well, you know, Daniel loves... A review of a Christmas book.
It was by Amy Bloom. I like Amy Bloom.
Okay. And the book is called Christmas, A Biography by Judith Flanders. Now, turns out we have a book by Judith Flanders
on our
bookshelf.
Oh, my goodness. This
yes,
is a surprise.
Inside the Victorian Home.
Oh, how have I missed this?
A Portrait of Domestic Life in Victorian England.
Oh, my goodness. Did you read that book?
Yes, I did read that
book.
How
was it?
It was good. Huh? You know, it's fun. You know, because my parents are antiquers, we have all these Victorian objects.
Yeah.
So there's always a little wondering in my mind, you know, how were all these things used? Were they really used, et cetera? Because, I have that book. And it's funny that she calls it Biography
of Christmas.
Of Christmas.
A nice turn of phrase, I would say.
Yeah. So anyway, and Bloom actually raves about the Victorian Home book as well in this article. But she's really pointing out that a lot of, should I read the opening?
I think the opening captures it. It's worth reading, yeah.
A.B. Bloom writing here, modern Christmas is a secular sham, and all the glorious, meaningful, and ancient, often religious traditions are being drowned in a vile pile of cheap paper, expensive pink trees, and SpongeBob Santas. Judith Flanders isn't having it.
There you go.
And what she's pointing out is that a lot of our nostalgia mm-hmm. is for aspects of Christmas that we kind of made up in our minds.
Right.
You know, that it's for a time that and events and traditions that didn't necessarily exist, that we like to think existed.
Right.
Top on that list seems to be... caroling in the mid-1800s. And we do have all these romantic visions of carolers mm-hmm. out in the snow. Mm-hmm. And she really seems to indicate that that was never the case. That is just something that has grown with our illustrations of the
time. I'm not shocked by that. I mean,
feasting has always feasting food has always been important to Christmas, but gift giving. Mm-hmm. Did you see what she said about gift giving?
I thought she said it was particularly with children came later or something like that.
Well, the thing is, it was gift giving was an important part of Christmas, but it was usually for actually the worker bees. Mm-hmm. It was kind of paying a tax to the landlord property. It was your time to bring big things, bring your contribution to the lord of the manor, so to speak. And that's what it was associated with. It wasn't necessarily such a happy, fun thing. And it's with the advent of Dickens that he kind of morphs it into a time when you're giving, you know, delightful gifts to friend and family, especially children.
Right. He brought the folks to the children. He was a little bit of a social reformer and, you know, turned around.
And there's a movie that addresses that to some extent.
Right. The Man Who Invented Christmas.
Right. So we'll have to go see that. And also she does point out that the gifts for the children at in Dickens' time were largely manufactured. Okay, they weren't charming homemade gifts. This vision of we're all sitting at home knitting little cute things and carving little fun toys for our kids. That's also sort of a fantasy. Mm-hmm. That it, you know, that didn't start out that way. We love and miss the past that never was.
Right, but I think she does, she's somewhat positive. I think she says that ultimately, you know, you end up, Christmas is really subject to the creation of the folks who in any particular point in time. Yeah. And you end up creating the Christmas that serves your needs at that time in history or whatever your family needs. And, you know, that makes perfect sense to me. I think
you shouldn't be agonizing that you're not doing it the good old way. And also, I mean, when we think back, you know, I mean, Santa is just such a total wonderful fabrication. Right. And really the more historic character is Krampus, who was actually half demon, half goat, and would chase after children who were bad and in some cases eat them.
But this is in what in what
well this is
in
Scandinavia in, yes no not Scandinavia so much as Germany and Austria.
Oh, really?
And it's a tradition that actually still goes on to some extent. I mean, there's no eating of children.
All right. So the point is the idea of people coming up with things that seem a little artificial or tinsely because it serves their purposes isn't so bad. So you're off the hook, Dixon. This is what it really means. You can be creative after all. All right. So you found yet another article about why exercise is the key to everything.
Is the key. And this is an article in the New York Times in the health in their health department, how exercise can make for healthier fat. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're not talking about olive oil here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the fat in your body. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, who knew, there is white fat and brown fat in your body. The brown fat's good. Mm-hmm. It burns calories. Okay.
Yeah.
And so then I had to Google all the ways we can increase our brown fat. So we're going to get on that. We're going to eat more cardamom.
Yeah.
And
cardamom in anything, I think, is good. It enhances the flavor.
Among other ways, almonds also will give you more brown fat. So that's good.
Right.
And apparently exercise can, you know, help white fat become brown fat as well.
Almonds?
Almonds, yeah. Almonds are really good for you. So, okay. So almond ice cream with the cardamom in it, it's going to cure everything. Right. So anyway, the important thing is to have healthy fat, okay? If your fat is leaky, that is leaking those fatty acids into the bloodstream, those roving fat blobs can accumulate in bad places. And the point is that can lead to
diabetes.
Yeah. Okay? So it's a little bit too hard to follow how all of this works, but they did a study. They had people... some people who exercise, some people don't exercise, all of them had fat. Mm. And when they tested their, I don't know, bloodstream or whatever, even the people who didn't normally exercise after they exercised, they had healthier fat.
Okay. So it's not a matter of eliminating fat, it's healthy fat.
Right.
Okay.
But I mean, if you have the brown fat, I think you're eliminating fat.
Yes, because you use it in the way we think of it. Yes, you are. Okay. You're certainly you're burning calories.
So, I mean, fat is an important thing. You need some fat.
Right. Okay. So, you mentioned to me that you saw there was an obituary in Today's Times of, as you put it, the pitcher who gave up a big home run to Roger Maris. And I was able to respond.
Yes, Roger Maris, the name I knew. I didn't know the pitcher.
And I said, oh, it must be Tracy Stallard who gave up his 61st home run. And it turns out Tracy Stallard did pass away today. So what that tells us, first of all, is yes, nostalgia is associated at least as much with baseball as it is with Christmas, because how else would I remember that Tracy Stallard gave up that home run to Roger Maris in 1961 when I'm not even a Yankee fan? But it was the 61st home run for Maris, and that stood as a record for a long time, and it made Tracy Stallard famous. And he was pleased about it, notwithstanding he gave up the home run. I will tell you, too, to tell you how much the game has changed. Tracy Stallard pitched 7 innings that day, gave up that one home run, and lost 1-0. So he was a pretty good pitcher, but the game has changed. But having said that, another interesting thing. At the time, in 1961, the record was set for two teammates hitting the most home runs because Mantle hit 56, and 56 and 61 is whatever it is. It's 117. And that remains the record for two teammates, but it's close now. Why? Because there are two teammates on the Yankees called Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton. And you're going to say to me, but Dan, Giancarlo Stanton is not on the Yankees. He's on the Marlins. And I would say, not anymore. Not so fast, Ms. Greener. Because the big news here is that there is a huge trade that is just being finalized right now, in which Giancarlo Stanton is reported to be going to the Yankees. And that is...
Well, you told me about that. You told me it's a bad trade.
No, it's bad for baseball. It's annoying to me because I'm a Mets fan. But it doesn't make much sense because how is it the Yankees got this guy? They don't need him nearly as much as many other teams.
So he's like the best guy in the universe at the moment.
He's the MVP of the National League. The Yankees have Aaron Judge, who was second in the MVP in the American League and is the best power hitter in the American League. So why would the Yankees be getting the two best power-hitting right fielders in baseball?
Didn't anybody else want him?
They did, and here's what happened. Here's the key to the whole thing. The key to the whole thing is that the general manager of the Marlins who traded Giancarlo Stanton is Derek Jeter.
Even I know that he used to be a Yankee.
He used to be a Yankee. And does this mean he's favoring the Yankees? No. Does this mean he knows what he's doing? Absolutely not. And the Yankees took advantage of this. Jeter made a fundamental mistake, number one, by announcing to the world that he had to trade Stanton because he couldn't afford him, thereby painting himself into a corner. Number two, Stanton had previously been granted a no-trade contract. He could decide who he would go to or not. Number three, several teams bid for him, aside from the Yankees, including the Giants and the Cardinals. But Stanton said, I'm only interested in the Yankees. And number four, Jeter said, oh, well, I guess then we'll deal with the Yankees. That you cannot do. What Jeter had to do was to say to Stanton, well, tough noogies, buddy, because we have to establish a market for your trade value, and you have to be open to other trades.
Well, do you think being a former player got in his way?
I think...
That he's respecting the guy's wants and needs in a way that a more
businessman...
I didn't
think about that. I didn't think about that.
More of a businessman wouldn't have taken that into consideration?
That is possible. I also think just the total lack of experience in the front office and managing a team.
But is he the only guy who would be involved in that decision?
He's the key guy. He's the key guy. And the Yankees, I think, took advantage of him because the Yankees were perhaps more attuned to his lack of sophistication.
How do you know the Yankees are evil?
They're evil.
They're evil.
Look, my prediction is it's not going to work out for the Yankees. It's bad karma. This goes back to the old days of the Yankees, signing every player who's available and spending $1 zillion. With any luck, this will come back to bite them. So changing from baseball to... the literary world. Back to book reviews. There was a book review of something called Keeping On Keeping On, which is a memoir by Alan Bennett.
It was a collection of some of his writings.
Right.
It's a combination of diary entries, various essays, a sermon
right.
that actually the reviewer here is...
The reviewer is David Ives. And David Ives is distinguished in his own right. He wrote Venus in Fur, among other things.
Right, he did that translation of The French Forest.
He did.
That we loved.
And yeah. What he, the point that he makes, and again, David Ives is no slouch, but this review is a tribute, really, to Alan Bennett. He has trouble staying focused on the book. He's just saying, it's hard to appreciate if you don't live in the UK what a revered figure.
What a superstar he is.
Alan Bennett is.
What a rock star.
Right.
He is. He's a playwright, a writer, an actor.
Television and screenwriter. And as Ives put it, he's become a public figure in the UK for whom the words English national treasure surround like a nimbus. So he's a big deal. He wrote The History Boys, among other things, the play. And
which is fun, and had James Corden in it.
That's right.
So, you know.
It was a great play. So the way Ives puts it is this. He said, still there, by the way, he doesn't love the memoir, but of course it's Bennett's third memoir, so there's so much memoir each of us have in us. But he says, still there are writers we turn to with almost religious gratitude. And Alan Bennett, for many people, is one. In an age of amnesia, he knows and honors the past. In a civilization ruined by cell phones and flip-flops, he is ink and paper, corduroy, and tweed. Hats off to anyone who can still identify tansy, crocketed pinnacles, or a blue tit.
And this all tickled me, because a couple of days ago, I was just introducing one of my classes to crocketed pinnacles.
It's about time.
And so a pinnacle is the pointy part at the top of kind of a tower. You'll see them on Gothic cathedrals. We were talking about Gothic cathedrals. And the crocket is the little curly thing that decorates the side of the pinnacles. And as a matter of fact, I have a crocket.
Okay.
Which was the new chapel built in the 20s, was designed to look like a Gothic cathedral. And there was a crocket that had fallen off a pinnacle on a balcony that we were on.
You know,
and I picked it up.
And look, there's no question that you have a tremendous connection, Alan Bennett.
Yes. Well, let me just say, I like to walk around, and the rest of the day I was walking around and wondering if anybody was going to ask me, is that a Crockett in your pocket?
Oh, my God. All right. I'm glad we experienced Alan Bennett as a character in other works
of art.
Well,
I read a fun book.
Well,
Love, Nina.
But it also was Lady in the Van, too.
Oh, Lady in the Van. Oh, so that was an episode from one of his memoirs, the previous one, about this woman, the homeless woman, who ends up living in a trailer in his driveway for 15 years.
Right.
And there was a movie
With Vanessa Redgrave and somebody, no, with Maggie Smith.
Yeah.
It was Maggie Smith and somebody playing Alan Bennett.
It was Maggie Smith, yes.
But somebody played Alan Bennett.
Yeah, and it was a great movie. I saw it by myself. Sometimes
right.
I have to go to movies like that. Alone.
I'm working.
Yes, but you're working. And then I was also going to say, it's a fun book, a memoir by a young woman who was a nanny in the 80s for Mary Kay Wilmers, the editor of the London Review.
Right.
And he's referred to as AB.
Right.
And
he's a neighbor.
Yeah. And so he pops in and out in the stories. And it's a delightful book. It's an easy, fun read and quick. And they even made a television series of it, adaptation of it, in the UK, which perhaps you can conjure up on Netflix.
Yeah, this is Nina Stibe. Is that what we decided her name was?
Yes, Stibbe. I don't know how you pronounce it in British, but it's a fun book.
It is a fun book, and he comes across as this brilliant curmudgeon-like character. And look, I guess the point is he's just an enormous figure over there, obviously not the same kind of figure in the U.S., but a very Aryanite and accomplished guy.
Yeah, and he's, you know, interesting and...
But in the category of folks that are figures that perhaps we're not that familiar with.
Not on everybody's radar.
We have another one.
Well, this guy, not at all on my radar. Now, I'm an art history person, not an English literature person. I'm reading books, you know, cute little books like Love, Nina in my spare time. But this is a review of a couple of books. It's from the Wall Street Journal, and it's about the W.M. Spackman.
Yeah, W.M. Spackman.
And there's a collection of his complete fiction, which is not so huge because he didn't start writing fiction until he was in his 70s, late in life.
Yeah.
And he's famous for a couple of short novels.
Well, he's not famous for anything.
Well, he's not famous. Well, I mean, the notable ones are An Armful of Warm Girl, A Difference of Design, A Little Decorum for Once, A Presence with Secrets. So there's that, and there's also a collection of his criticism.
Right. And the article that we've got here in the journal describes him as a stylist and compares him to some well-known authors like Cormac McCarthy and James Salter. And I can tell you that you would call Cormac McCarthy, and even more so James Salter, as extremely accomplished stylists. And anybody who's going to be compared that way to James Salter has to be really something.
Yes. Well, you know, he must be really something. He went to Princeton.
He did.
And he comes from Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And he was a Rhodes Scholar. Right. He specialized in classics.
All right. Well,
so
impeccable.
Impeccable. And so maybe, and so in reading, it's a big article. It's a big review.
Right.
And to be honest, I was taken with a lot of what he had to say.
Right.
I was taken with some of the little the quips from his criticism, and also from one of his books. And here we have Derrida, Michael Derrida, the reviewer, saying, "At times, Spackman's long, rushing sentences, his serpentine streams of consciousness, barely stop for a breath." And here's an example. "Mrs. Barclay, being as it turned out, late, and Nicholas, early, or as early anyway as a man in his right mind, waiting for a pretty woman, he sat damn near 20 minutes in Veal's unrecognizable bar, bolt upright and presently glaring, before with a ripple of high heels influttered his angel in this breathless rush at last, blissfully gasping, 'Oh, Nicholas, oh, simply now, imagine,' as he lunged up from the banquette with a happy bellow to grab her, though this act she parried, after one radiant flash of blue eyes, by seizing and tenderly pressing his hands while uttering little winded cries of salutation and reminiscence, and having let him merely peck at one heavenly cheek, eeled out of his arms to the seat, onto which she at once sank blown."
Yeah, well, that's, first of all, let's say rippling high heels, ripple, and eeling out of his arms. I mean, that's style. That's something. Rippling high heels. I'll have to think about that one.
The ripple of high heels.
The ripple of high heels.
Well, okay. You know, that might be auditory.
Look, I thought that was great. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, so he seems very interesting. So.
He does. Yeah. I mean, look, it's a total shot in the dark. That's what Kindle's all about.
That's why we keep reading. You know,
you never know.
Finding new people.
So there's something that here in the Times that was kind of funny about Quebec. And Quebec apparently is putting its foot down about the way shopkeepers greet people who come into the shop. Apparently things are getting out of hand. Folks have been walking into shops in Quebec, and shopkeepers have been saying, "Bonjour, hi." Well,
this follows Pastagate.
Yes, Pastagate.
Which was a whole lawsuit about a restaurant using the word pasta
on its menu.
On the menu when everything's supposed to be in French.
Yeah, well, yes, there are language laws that make French the official language of the government.
People are worried about losing the French language.
They are. So they passed this ordinance, 111-0, which says that no longer can shopkeepers say bonjour, hi. They must simply say bonjour. It is not clear what the penalty is.
Not everybody's happy about this.
Oh, the shopkeepers are crazed about it because they think they're in the business of making money.
Right.
And they think they're in a bilingual city. Well, apparently they're not. I can understand why they're misled. There have been some recent relaxations of the ordinances. Apparently the phrase grilled cheese has come into acceptance in Quebec and a few similar phrases. Having said that, though, in France, it's still the case, supposedly, that the failure to greet a stranger with a hearty bonjour can invite icy silence. So that's what they're aspiring to in Quebec, that kind of icy silence. And
this is the nature of language.
Yes.
Okay. again, I was just explaining to my class about how English morphed from Anglo-Saxon, you know, Old English, and Urfather, Thathart, on Heovnum. I took this class in Old English from John Fleming in Princeton. And in 1066, when William the Conqueror takes over, the Normans, who, you know, from France, bring French, and then our language changes to begin to sound more like the way we talk today. So, you know,
The most important thing is, the most important thing is you can get a grilled cheese sandwich in Quebec at this point. But that takes us to another food article, which is has to do with Italy, which I thought was just something that existed in Manhattan.
No, there are Italy's all over, to be honest. New York, Chicago, I think in Milan. And now there's a huge one in Bologna. And they call it, they don't call it Italy. They call it actually FICO, F-I-C-O, which I'm not going to bore you with my Italian, but it means Italian farming factory, actually, is the translation. And what it is this giant kind of, well, I don't know, you might even call it a food mall with all these stands. With foods, wines, etc., to buy and try. And it also has demonstration, little areas where they're showing you how to make pasta, how pasta is made, and you can participate. And our intrepid reporter, Evan Rail, who goes to Bologna, and you can take a bus right out to the site quite easily. He goes and he's, you know, trying to experience all of this. And he stops to learn how to make tortellone at one little stand.
Not as easy as it looks.
And and he's having a little bit of trouble. And elderly women are beginning to gather around and give him advice. And his teacher refers to them as the local Zadora. Which translates apparently to something like food cooker ladies. Evan says, I might have not known exactly what I'd find at FICO, but I hadn't traveled all this way to get heckled by somebody's grandma.
Well, apparently he had.
And so he's not quite sure. There's some educational material there. He's not quite sure what FICO is trying to be. Is it a shopping mall with culinary classes? Is it an educational center? Is it just an homage to Italian food culture gone wild? But he does have one transformative experience there. He tastes culatello, which is a dried ham so rare it doesn't even have a Wikipedia page in English. And he says it's smells funky, like a well-aged blue cheese, richly aromatic, slightly phenolic. It was easily the best single thing he tasted at FICO, perhaps ever.
Sounds like a Spackman-like description.
So if you're in Bologna,
Head over. Well, who knew? It's a worldwide phenomenon.
So of course, we could always go to Italy in New York City. It's pretty darn good.
I haven't been there, I don't think. Have you?
Yes.
Oh, well, okay.
I've been there.
All right, good for you. All right, so you had, we were going to close with something which we both thought was very interesting about a woman's career as a professor.
Yeah, so I'm not often driven to read the articles that have law as the main topic, so I don't know why I read this, but it was quite interesting. It's titled, A Law Professor's Long, Relentless Drive for Trust, and it's about Tamar Frankel, who at 92 years old is still shaking up Wall Street as the intellectual godmother of fiduciary rule. She was born in Palestine in 1925. She joined the Haganah, the paramilitary movement for Israeli independence, at age 14. I just mentioned that because it might have contributed to her sort of spirit of independence and self-reliance. Her father was the first president of Israel's Bar Association. Mm-hmm. She will end up taking over his practice. When he dies, at a certain point, she comes to the U.S. She goes to the Harvard Law School and ends up writing her dissertation on variable annuities and mutual funds, mashups of mutual funds and insurance. She said, I didn't know anything about mutual funds. And she said, there are two ways to react. You can just, to something you don't know about. One way is just throw up your hands and run. The other is to, really invest yourself in it. And she goes on to join Boston University. They give her an office. She's the first female law professor at Boston University. I think that's in 1972. They give her an office in the basement of the library. Okay. And far from being insulted or upset that she's away from everybody in the basement, she's thrilled. She says, the craving for being part of the group, being accepted, that wasn't my priority. And she said, besides, I never had to put my books away. Mm-hmm. And so she still is teaching today. She says she will retire perhaps July 4th when she turns 93. What accounts for her longevity? She replies, caring less and less about what other people think, she says, and more about questions you don't have answers to.
See, I thought that was a great quote. That made the whole thing for me. And that is such a guiding principle at any point in your career, as far as I'm concerned. It's so easy to get carried away and distracted with what other people think. And there's so much to be investigated and to consider about questions that don't have answered. You shouldn't be distracted by that. And obviously this person wasn't. So I think that's great.
Yeah, very impressive. So on that note, we go back to the snow.
The snow.
And the festivities coming up with Christmas and Hanukkah starting this week. Hanukkah, Hanukkah, light the menorah. You know,
still can't
I'm going to get those latkes going.
Still can't get
to ready.
Sing Sondheim. But those,
everybody loves a latke.
That's the second song. First was Chock Full of Nuts. Now it's the Hanukkah songs. We're getting there. Until next week. This is Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
Good night.